Talk is the most dangerous thing in the world, says a KGB agent in Richard Lorre's new novel, Zero Gravity. Lorre knows firsthand about the power of words through his work translating Soviet and Polish writers. He's translated manuscripts by Andrei Sakharov that were smuggled out of the Soviet Union. He's also translated Visions from San Francisco Bay by Polish Nobel laureate Czesław Miłosz, and the recent novel Moscow 2042 by Vladimir Voinovich. Zero Gravity is Lorre's satire about Soviet-American relations in the age of glasnost. The novel begins with some insights into the character of the top KGB agent in Washington.
Leonid Poplavsky was a busy man. Not only was he the Soviet cultural attaché in Washington, he was the KGB chief in charge of all espionage on the Eastern Seaboard, a position known in the trade as the resident. Poplavsky believed in doing both jobs well. And not only because the more screenings, concerts, and readings he organized, the less likely the Americans would be to determine his actual function. He liked art because it was beautiful and had so little to do with life, which, if the truth be told, was a clumsy business. Although he believed that art should, of course, serve the people and the party, it did so best by staying away from life. Muddy boots are not improved by walking over a Persian rug, Poplavsky was fond of saying.
By the way, I like that saying a lot. Muddy boots are not improved by walking over a Persian rug. Is that an actual Russian saying, or did you make that one up for the book?
I made it up.
Okay.
But it sounds like it might be, right?
It sure does, yeah.
Maybe it will be.
Do you think that the position of cultural attaché makes a good cover for a KGB man?
Why not? The whole book is about, in some ways, about using culture for political purposes, so it fits in entirely, I would say.
Well, exactly. I mean, to you, glasnost is the era of public relations, and art, you think, has become a public relations tool in the era of glasnost.
Well, it's certainly usable. I mean, everything is politically usable or economically usable in our day and age, it seems. So it's played by one market or another, one candidate or another, one system or another.
The public relations gimmick in your book, and part of the story that the book turns on, is a poetry reading on the moon. Would you explain the premise of that?
The poet has an enormous role in Russian culture, which would be, it's unimaginable for us, but it's the equivalent of a rock star. So they have that tradition of literature, and they wanted to exploit that tradition of high culture and literature, and this was part of a propaganda PR move against SDI, basically. So they thought, we have to do something that shows that space should be humanized and culturalized. And after sorting through a few possibilities, they settled on the idea of a poet reading from the moon.
Now, in your novel, the information that the Soviets plan on sending a poet to the moon is leaked to the Americans. So the Americans hold a competition to find an American poet that they could send to the moon. And the American who wins that contest, who wins the contest and is selected to go to the moon and read a poem there, becomes an overnight celebrity. But still, nobody's buying his books of poetry. No one actually wants to read him, even though he's famous. Does that kind of sum up the absurd plight of poets in America to you?
Well, that among other things. I happen to know of people who have even won the Nobel Prize in literature, and it had and they became instantly world famous if they weren't before, and it had no perceptible effect on actual sales. So a poet can be a celebrity, he can even become wealthy, but whether he can make a living is another matter entirely.
Well, in your novel, there ends up being plans for a joint poetry reading on the moon with both a Soviet and an American poet participating. When they meet each other on the moon, they each express their envy for the other. Would you explain what they each envy about each other?
Well, the Russian poet simply envies the American poet's ability to hop on an airplane and go to Paris. In other words, the simple freedoms. We said you can hop on a plane to Paris like it was a number 6 bus, which was fairly unimaginable to him. On the other hand, the American poet envies the seriousness with which literature is taken in Russia. Poets are exiled, poets are imprisoned, poets are banned. So that's what they each envy in the other. And in the end, they try to rectify the balance, let's say, without giving away certain plot elements.
Do you know any Soviet emigre writers who came to America and were disappointed disappointed not only about life here, but also about losing their readers.
Yeah, there's a disappointment for Russian writers who come to America, and it has many sources. One is that they tended to idealize America. They saw it as a kind of, I don't know quite what, but maybe some Athenian-type society where people discussed great ideas and voted continuously and however they imagined the mechanism of democracy. And they found it more banal and commercial and, anyway, other than they had imagined it. So there was a disappointment. On the other hand, they're still treated as heroes, and their books do reach the Soviet Union one way or the other, and they feel that they're part of something that's important and enduring, the tradition of Russian literature, and that sustains most of them. Most of them do all right.
You know, the character who's the KGB Eastern Seaboard head, who's also the cultural attaché, the character who you were reading about in the opening reading, he says at one point in your novel that, you know, they really do refuse Nix a favor by not letting them out of the Soviet Union. And he says, now look what happens if you let a poet come to America. He comes to the West. For 2 weeks, he's a hero. For 2 weeks, he's news. Then he's a depressed immigrant on the lecture circuit if he's lucky, and on welfare if he's not. American publishers don't like his new work expressing autumnal melancholy of exile from Russia. And worse, it turns out that he's not such a big liberal after all, thereby alienating the little clique of American East Coast liberals who control American culture. So that's pretty funny.
Well, the thing is, one thing I sort of perversely enjoy doing is giving odd characters, I liked putting that in the mouth of a KGB agent because it's almost true, and yet it's a burlesque of the truth, but it's being used by him for the most horrible reasons, basically to deny someone their human rights and civil liberties. So that's the sort of perverse twist of it.
I'm interested in how you first got started translating.
How I remember distinctly the moment when I realized I could be a translator. I was working with Czesław Miłosz, the Polish poet, in Berkeley, California in the early 60s, and we were translating some very obscure Polish poems at the time, and he said to me, you know, you could make a living from this, Richard. And I hadn't realized that was possible. It seemed like a great idea. You stay home, smoke cigarettes, sip coffee, translate books from one language to another, and actually get paid for it. So I did it. I translated 25 books and a great number of articles, essays, letters of protest, poems, you name it.
Have you worked on manuscripts that had to be smuggled out of Poland or the Soviet Union?
Sure. I worked on, when Andrei Sakharov was exiled to Gorky, he was writing his autobiography, which was twice stolen from him by the KGB, and it was being sent out of the country, and I was translating it in pieces, bits and pieces, as it arrived, and it was very important that be kept entirely quiet. Now he's able to work on his autobiography in peace and openly in his apartment in Moscow, and that manuscript is now being sort of finished up by both of us and will be in print hopefully sometime in late 88.
Gee, you know, I guess in a way being a translator makes for some good experience for writing espionage novels.
It definitely does. You definitely get plugged into the actual network of the emigre underground, and you start having to do certain things. As soon as you're not discussing something over the telephone just in case, you're already partaking of the mindset and the paranoia, or the care, whatever you prefer to call it. And your nerves are being affected. You're playing the game.
You know, I'm thinking it really must be quite a responsibility to do the kind of translating that you're doing. The safety of a lot of people is in part dependent on your ability to keep a secret.
You have to know how to keep a secret. It's an important thing in that aspect, in that area of life, and in other areas of life. So the thing is, I've been doing this kind of stuff for about 25 years, and it probably takes 10 or 12 years to establish yourself, and for people, not only in terms of your ability, but in terms of your character, you have to be known as someone who can be basically, it's a question of trust and someone who can be relied on.
Richard Lurie's new novel is called Zero Gravity. He spoke to us from NPR station WGBH in Boston. This is Fresh Air.